Continue. And there we go. All right, now I'm going to turn it over to Guy. Well, they see.
Sort of. Okay.
They see.
Hello, I'm Guy Brandenburg. I'm the current president of National Capital Astronomers, and I want to welcome those in attendance and those at home to our February monthly meeting.
Hey, Guy, you might want to sort of so you're speaking to the computer, but don't forget the people in here.
Well, that's why I wanted to sit over there, but
Yeah, but the thing is,
okay.
then the camera can't would only see you and not the people in the room.
Okay, did I just unplug something?
Nope, you should be good.
I did unplug
Oh,
something.
power. That would eventually be a problem. That
All
shouldn't
right.
be.
Sorry, boys and girls. That's an interesting thing. Okay, sorry about that. So, hope that goes to the next slide. Okay,
Yes.
so two of the largest and most ambitious grounded space telescopes that are in the works right now are both named after deceased female members of NCA professional astronomers. That's the Vera Rubin Observatory, which used to be called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. That's well under construction in Chile, and the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which Dr. Bennett, I think I misspelled it, sorry about that, will be telling us about during this meeting. It was very wonderful to have those two incredible scientists as members of NCA. Total eclipse is about 6 weeks away. And I don't know if you guys can put up your hands to sh say if you're going for this event to totality someplace. Show of hands, anybody here going? Only two of us in present. How about anybody else? Anybody else going? Not that. Okay, David Bennett raised his hand. Anybody else? Okay, David, where are you going to? Todd is also.
Maybe Buffalo. My daughter just moved there, but if the weather's really bad, I might go somewhere else.
Okay. It's famous for being bad there, isn't it? Todd, where are you going?
Wherever the sun's shining.
Okay, good. And John, I think.
I'm gonna take advantage of driving north of Pittsburgh approximately 2 hours. The crowds along the lake, I've already heard some expectation at Presque Isle State Park. They think there'll be a quarter of a million, 250,000 people. I don't even know how they'll fit them on the beach area. Cleveland, the Guardians have a ball game up there. They're going to stop the game for the eclipse. I'm going north to an extremely rural area. It's called the Erie Wildlife Refuge. It's the only fish and game wildlife refuge in the United States that is east of the Mississippi, and I'm going to go on a hiking trail because I want to be very remote by myself and essentially to see the reaction of the animals and the birds and all of that. There will be some migration that still goes on in that part of Pennsylvania, and even if it's cloudy, I intend to go because it will be an area of totality where I'll be is about a minute to a minute and a half. The closer to the lake, you get closer to 4 minutes.
Anybody else? Yes.
Yeah, my name's Ron. I'm going to Niagara Falls.
Oh, okay. So where I'm going is Austin, which is right on the edge, and I haven't decided whether to go in the center line or towards the edge.
Guy, I'm going to Round Rock, Texas, which is a suburb of Austin. And we're in the path, the hotel's in the path of the totality, but we'll be looking at the weather and seeing what we can do with regards to traffic.
Okay, so if you're staying in DC region, there are some events planned. And like I was saying earlier, I think before we officially started, it's going to be very good partial eclipse. And who has details on event? Do you, Elizabeth?
So we are holding an event here at the University of Maryland, being pushed by the college. It will be on campus somewhere. We're still developing the details of exactly where on campus. It'll probably be somewhere in walking distance of the hotel so that the public can park at the hotel and then kind of walk onto campus. That'll save them from having to find parking on a school day. And because it will be a school day and it's during the school day. So parking on campus would be difficult. Not like a Saturday or Sunday that parking is open. So we're still developing the plans. So we'll have some activities. Figuring out what our rain plan would be if we're going to do like an indoor, have an indoor location somewhere. But we're developing those, and those should get finalized here before the end of February.
Okay. And I understand that the National Air and Space Museum folks will have something also.
Yeah, I volunteer at Air and Space, and we're putting on a big presentation.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay.
Well, I think both locations would greatly appreciate the help of any members who are staying in town come and help. I know, at least here in Maryland, it would really be good to have at least one or two NCA members attend it, because one of the things that we kind of said in our letter was, you know, about the great partnership between NCA and the observatory and supporting outreach events and stuff. And things like that. So it would be really nice to try to have some NCA members attending this, as now that, because he's, my department chair is going to be watching that.
Yeah. Did you all hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get that together. All right. I've got a bunch of Eclipse glasses. You know how to reach me, I hope. If you want some, we got plenty. Oopsie, next slide. Okay, so here we go. And upcoming is a science fair at the Northern Virginia region, and that's at Wakefield High School. And if anybody is here who's going to go to that, this we should give to each person that we talk to who has an astronomy related exhibit, whether we think they're worthy of a prize or not. We should definitely give each one of them one of those glasses. And in addition, we should also give them what some sort of calling cards that we have made in the past. Here's the front. And the back says, congratulations on your science, technology, engineering, math project. Your project has been reviewed by a member of NCA. And here's that part. So, okay. So we have quite a few volunteers this year, more volunteers than ever for the science fair, which is really, really nice. So we need new officers next year. New vice president is needed. John Hornstein says, you know, he's not doing it anymore. Very important job. This person is the person who finds speakers for us. And nominations and elections will be this April and May. And I will be selecting some folks to go out and drum up candidates. It's a labor of love. It's not like you get a salary and a stipend and a fancy car. And I would love if somebody else would do it, my job. But that's coming up. All right. And that's all the things that I had to say. And so I'm going to stop sharing my screen. And does anybody else have any other announcements they would like to make at this point? Jay.
Yeah. As some of you might have noticed, you might not have gotten your Stardust. Yeah. All of a sudden, I got a new iMac, and all of a sudden I've had problems sending out Stardust, and I've been in contact with Apple and spoke to three people. None of them were able to solve the problem. So if somebody would be willing to take over the job, all they have to do is get the membership list and just send out Stardust. It's not really that big a deal. It's very easy. Once you've got the membership list, just mail out the PDF. That's it. Okay, but would very much appreciate if somebody could, take that over.
Okay, so Jay, I'll do it since I have to finish off the PDF anyway. I've always wondered why we were doing the extra step of sending it to you, kind of. And so, yeah, I'll work with Jim Simpson to get an updated copy of, you know, the current members who get the newsletter list. But the newsletter did go out this afternoon to all the people who are members. I just included Capital Astronomers just in case to make sure. But everyone should have gotten their
newsletter. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but that means that people have to be on the list served, and not everybody maybe is on the list served.
Okay. I think it looks like we have a solution to that problem.
Yeah, fine. Great. Okay.
In addition, I think we should move the schedule for getting these out to the public a few days earlier. I would
get
to the members about a week before the event, rather than the day of the event or the day before.
Well, normally it would have been several days earlier.
I sent the newsletter to Jay like Tuesday or Wednesday for sure.
Yes. And I tried to send it out then. But I had problems.
Okay. Harold, did you have something you wanted to say?
I just wanted to thank Elizabeth for saving us. And I'll be at Montgomery College during the eclipse with telescopes pointed at partial.
Okay, so we should get you some large number of eclipse glasses as well.
Yes, please.
Okay, and obviously to you as well.
No, I have 3,000 glasses.
3,000. Okay, that's probably enough.
We have some here for some of the members to take as well.
Okay.
That way I'm not using it. I took two NCA ones just because I like to collect the different glasses from everyone. I have a nice collection of all the different eclipse glasses from over the years. But no, feel free to take some of the other ones from some other sources.
All right.
That way we're not using up all the NCA ones.
Okay. Anything else? If nothing else, then John?
Okay. It's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. David Bennett, who is our speaker this evening. In graduate school in the Department of Physics at Stanford University, his research was on difficult questions at the interface between the physics of quantum fields and the possible physics of the early universe, with the goal of understanding the processes that eventually led to the present state of the universe. One goal was to evaluate potential mechanisms that could have seeded the formation of galaxies. This research required a mastery of very sophisticated theoretical physics and mathematics. In this work, he also used data from the Differential Microwave Radiometer on the Cosmic Background Explorer spacecraft. That radiometer provided information on the variations of the strength of the cosmic microwave background radiation on different directions in the sky. At that time, he was also interested in the nature of dark matter, which is still one of the major questions in physics and cosmology. Brown dwarfs and massive compact halo objects were the two least exotic candidates for being dark matter. And a recent paper at that time had pointed out that gravitational microlensing would be a plausible way of detecting those types of objects. This evening's talk will explain what gravitational microlensing is. but its great advantage is that it allows the detection of a massive object that is too dim to be seen by telescopes. It does this by detecting the general relativistic deflection and brightening of the light from that too dim object. When light comes from objects in the background of the too dim object. After receiving his PhD, after receiving his PhD, Dr. Bennett and his wife greatly developed the technique of gravitational microlensing and applied it to the detection of exoplanets having masses even as small as that of the Earth. Dr. Bennett now leads the group at the Goddard Space Flight Center that uses gravitational microlensing to detect dim objects. That group has even detected free-floating planets that no longer orbit a star and has shown the surprising result that free-floating planets are quite numerous. Dr. Bennett.
Okay. All right, so the work I'm going to show is is due to a number of different groups. So this slide shows my current team at NASA Goddard, some of my former postdocs, and then some members of the Goddard team also work with this high angular resolution follow-up team, and I'll show some results from them. As I'm going to explain, the gravitational microlensing is the method to basically study the coolest planets. The Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope was approved by the 2010 Decadal Survey. We gave it the name WFIRST, and the Nancy Grace Roman name came just a few years ago. Basically, the idea is to complete the demographic study of the properties of planetary systems that was started by the Kepler mission. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why we need such a sort of statistical census of planets. Planet formation is a really difficult subject, and we haven't really had great success in understanding how planets form. We of course know that they do, and all the planets orbiting the sun are pretty much in the same plane, so it was assumed that they formed in a disk. And the original theory of formation of exoplanets predicted these features we see in the solar system, that inner planets are small and rocky. Gas giants are only found beyond the snow line, where it's cold enough for ices to condense, and there's more solid matter. And solid matter is thought to trigger the formation of the most massive planets. And then also it was thought that that planets would grow very rapidly from the sizes of Uranus or Neptune up to the sizes of Jupiter and Saturn. But in fact, all these conclusions are wrong. The first exoplanet found around a normal star was a planet of intermediate between Jupiter and Saturn's mass orbiting in a four-day orbit around a solar-like star. And there's also a lot of sort of hot sub-Neptune planets that have a significant fraction of hydrogen and helium gas found by Kepler that are in close orbits as well. And also, finally, I'll show from microlensing that we know that intermediate-sized giant planets between the masses of Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune are pretty common. All right, so the leading theory for planet formation is called the core accretion theory, And so this holds that you know, the protoplanets start to form, they start forming solids beyond the ice line, and then once they get to around 10 Earth masses, they start accreting hydrogen, helium gas, and it was thought that that accretion greatly accelerated when the planet, the protoplanets, get up to around 20 Earth masses. Some of the original calculations actually had these planets migrating through the protoplanetary disks, but this was ignored because we didn't have such planets in the solar system. All right, and frankly, the planet formation is complicated enough so that that really a theory doesn't make a lot of really strong predictions. And basically what theorists do is try to come up with ways to explain the planets that we detect. And so it's basically a field of astronomy that's really led by my observations. Okay, so this is a picture from a paper by Matthew Penny et al. In 2019, showing the sort of expected yield of planets from, it says W first, but that's Nancy Grace Roman, compared to actual detections from Kepler. And you see that they the sensitivity is pretty similar at the sort of Earth and Venus size, Earth and Venus separations. But there it's actually somewhat challenging to detect those planets with both Kepler and with microlensing. Another unique thing is that microlensing is sensitive to free-floating planets. And I'll show some results that we already have from ground-based data toward the end of the talk. Okay, this is a similar plot showing some of the planets that have been detected already from multiple methods. And this time, instead of showing the semi-major axis on the x-axis, dividing the semi-major axis by the snow, by the approximate location of the snow line. Okay, and so this indicates that the only method that's really sensitive to low mass planets beyond the snow line is microlensing. Radio velocities can detect some, but they have a lot of trouble getting down to even 10 Earth masses beyond the snow line.
That?
Sorry?
Why is that?
Why
do you have a hard time finding those beyond the snow line?
For radio velocities, the radio velocities, they depend on the separation between the planet and the star. And the larger that separation is, the slower the velocities.
Okay.
And so, and I'll explain in a minute why microlensing is sensitive to these wider orbit planets. It's harder to find planets by transits as well, because the angle, to see a transit, you basically have to have, the planet go in front of the host star, and the further the planet out is, the less likely it is to pass in front of the host star, because it's further away. It has to be a much better alignment to orbit. Generally it's thought that to confirm a transiting planet, you have to have multiple transits. And so for, a planet like Saturn, you got to wait 20 years for a second transit. And they don't last very long. So if you miss a few days, then you might have missed it. All right. So this slide shows a diagram that was in Physics Today about 20 years ago, sort of showing what happens when a star and its planet pass in front of a background star. So if the alignment isn't very good, you don't really see much of a change. But once the alignment gets better, you start to see the effect of two images, the light rays that pass on either side of the star get magnified and distorted. And the separation of these for lensing events with source stars in our galaxy is the transverse distance between the light rays that pass close to the star is only around a milliarc second, so a thousandth of an arc second. And then if one of these light rays that's bent by the star happens to pass close to the planet, you can create new images that actually can be quite bright because of the lensing factor of the planet. And so what we observe, since we don't have angular resolution to measure separations of a thousandth of an arc second, we just see the changing magnification. And so the red curve on top sort of shows a sort of cartoon example of that. And so, these things are changing, of course, because both the source star and the lens star are orbiting within our galaxy. So the alignment that gives this magnification is something that's temporary. And so the peak sensitivity is given by these bending angles. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute. So the best place to look for this, the main difficulty with this method is that these alignments are very rare. So if you look at a given star in the densest field in our galaxy, near the intergalactic bulge, near the galactic center, any particular star at any time, there's a probability of a few per million that that star will be magnified by this gravitational lensing effect. So, to see this effect regularly, then we have to be monitoring at least tens of millions of stars, and it's better if we can monitor hundreds of millions. And so the primary location to look is toward the galactic center or the galactic bulge. The galactic center itself has a great deal of dust extinction, and so that makes observations pretty difficult. All right, so this is what it would look like if you could resolve the lensing. On the left is a case of perfect alignment between the background source and the foreground lens. And so the location of the background source is that red dot. But if there's a perfect alignment, then by symmetry, you have to have a ring image. This is referred to as an Einstein ring because Einstein published the first paper on this that used general relativity, and he discussed this. The lensing effects are easiest to detect if the planet is in the vicinity of the Einstein ring. Partly this is because the magnification gets quite large when the planet is close to, or when the alignment is close to perfect, and so the features seen in the light curve can be much brighter, and so this is where our prime sensitivity is. If the planet is very close to its host star, then the magnified images have very low magnification. If it's far away, you can get magnified images if the lens star is separated by many Einstein radii, but it's not so likely that you detect both the lensing by the star and by the planet, and so the probability is also less. And so These Einstein rings, depending on the mass of the star, are typically at 2 or 3 astronomical units. And this is where we're most sensitive. And so this is why that microlensing is complementary to a transit mission like Kepler, which is much more sensitive to planets in short period orbits. Okay, so this is an example of what we would have seen if we had, if we had sort of micro arc second resolution of the first planet found by microlensing. And so what you see, there's a blue dot going across the Saturn. That's the location of the source. The purple things that sort of orbit around the green circle, which is just the Einstein ring, those are the images. And one of those images passes close to the planet. There's new images that are created, and they yield this light curve shown in the bottom panel. It has these two spikes. These are Costa crossings where the new images are created and where they disappear. Okay, so this is fairly typical of planetary microlensing, that you have a short duration signal that can be actually quite large. So this one more than doubles the magnification of the star due to the planetary host star. And so this is actually what we observe, and this is shown sort of superimposed the image of one of the telescopes that discovered this event. So it basically requires that you take observations very frequently so that you can see these short duration brightenings. Okay, now I'm going to show some more videos. This is from the third planet found by microlensing, but at the time, the mass of the planet is estimated to be about 5.5 Earth masses, and at the time it was the lowest mass planet that was found. So I'm going to show some similar slides, but these are going to be similar video, but these are going to be to scale. And so the images are pretty small compared to the Einstein radius. And so we have to change the perspective a little bit. So the red circle is the location of the source star. There's the blue circle is Einstein radius. And now we're focusing in on one of the images that's created by the star. And you see that little orange spot coming up from the lower left. And then it joins with the image and basically forms a little Einstein ring that goes across, that image that's distorted by the star. And here's just a close-up of that, comparing it to this, what you would see if the planet mass was 3 times larger. So basically, what's happening is that the larger planet disturbs the image over a wider area, right? So you can see the hole in that image is larger. We don't actually observe that. We just observe that the area of the image is larger when this larger planet is acting on it. And so, we see a larger variation in its brightness. And so this is for an event that had a giant source star that's about 10 times the radius of the sun. But we used a solar image to make these videos. I think a H alpha image, in fact. Okay, so the thing that limits the lowest mass that you can detect is finite source size. And so this picture is from the first calculation of finite source effects in this gravitational microlensing by planets. And you see that for this event, this is a close-up on a planetary signal for basically sources of different radii. And so as the radii gets larger and larger, the signal gets washed out. This means that it's difficult to find the lowest mass planets with giant source stars, and main sequence stars that are at least 10 times smaller than most common giants yield more sensitivity to low mass planets, and we can pretty easily see planets down to Mars masses, which is a tenth of an Earth mass. Okay, so this slide shows a magnification pattern of a relatively large a planetary system with a relatively massive planet. Okay, so you know, the color scheme going from black to reddish to yellow indicates a magnification. And, you know, this white star, that's the location of the host star. And just over here on the right is where the lens is located. All right, so, but we can never see this magnification pattern because we don't have sources illuminating the full plane. Instead, we rely on background stars moving. So in this case, if the background star follows this red dotted line, or sorry, it's white dotted line, we see lensing due to the star, but we don't see anything related to the planet. Okay, so so we can see a lot of lensing by stars that may have planets that we don't detect. If you have instead a star going here, then you see a relatively small magnification from the star, but then when it crosses these caustics, the image gets much brighter. And you notice the area of this caustic region is much bigger than this central caustic. Okay, but there's some advantages of the central caustics, even though the you know, you have to have more precise alignment to see a central caustic, to see the effect of a central caustic caused by a planet. And so there are two things that make these events interesting is one, that you can predict that you're going to come close to the central caustic if the magnification keeps rising and rising. Okay, and this was very common in the early days of planet searches, that when the ground-based telescopes didn't have quite the areas that they have today, there were a lot of follow-up groups that would try to detect planets, and they would focus their time on these high magnification events because the probability of detecting a planet in such event is much higher. Furthermore, they're also very bright. And so so we have teamed with a number of amateur astronomers who can observe these when they're very bright. And they've contributed to a lot of particularly the earliest planet detections from microlensing. And you know, a big advantage of amateur astronomers is that they rarely have someone else scheduled to use their telescope. And so, you know, the times that these things would occur are not so predictable. But if you, you know, own your own telescope and don't mind, you know, staying up all night before going to work in the morning, then you can find some planets. All right. And then this just shows how you extract the planetary signals. So this is a single lens event, and the planetary signal is here, and the offset from the peak the offset from the peak to the time of the planetary signal gives us a separation in units of the Einstein ring. And then, you know, planets of different masses then yield different shaped light curves. And so if you have good data, covering the planetary signal, then you can identify the mass ratio. Okay, so I'm going to show some results from the MOA collaboration. This is originally a New Zealand Japan collaboration, and so this map, the Japanese map of New Zealand, is sort of appropriate. The U.S. joined around the time of the first planet discovery, and so they're located on the South Island. It would be nice if the sky always looked like this. But, and actually, so the seeing isn't that great in New Zealand, but we did get a break during the pandemic when telescopes in New Zealand were one of the very few telescopes that were open. Okay, so this is the result of a statistical analysis of 29 planets, mostly found by the MOA survey. And so this this plot here shows the sensitivity to planets as a function of the mass ratio and the separation in units of the Einstein radius. So you see that we're sensitive to much wider range of separations when the mass ratio is relatively high. And we're less sensitive for lower mass planets. But the sensitivity is still highest with separations close to an Einstein ring. So here, this histogram shows the number of planets detected in each bin of mass ratios. However, these planets, the lower mass ratio planets, are much harder to detect. And if you correct for this selection effect, you convert this black histogram to the red one. Okay, and we fit a broken power law model with a peak or maybe just a break at a mass ratio of 10 to the minus 4. So that's for a subsolar mass star that's around the mass of Uranus or Neptune. Since most of our stars are less massive than the sun, their mass ratio is, so both Uranus and Neptune have a mass ratio less than 10 to the minus 4. All right. So this tells us that, you know, Neptune mass planets are common beyond the snow line. And you also notice that there doesn't seem to be a gap between sort of Neptune masses and Saturn masses. It seems to be a straight power law. So I also compared this to some population synthesis calculations by two different groups. There's Ida and Lynn and the Byrne group. And so population synthesis calculations are attempts to sort of explain a whole planet formation process, but they basically have to use sort of approximations for each kind of physical step in the process. And so so it's not like it's not so much a solid, physics-based calculation. They have to make a lot of approximations. And so they've been trying to do that to try and fit different types of data. And it's not a big surprise that it didn't quite work when they compared to ours, because they hadn't fit for that kind of form. And so there's two histograms here there's two histograms in each of these plots. And so originally they tried with migration, and this didn't fit very well at all. Many fewer planets over the whole mass range for both of these. And then they tried turning off migration. And so that managed to get much closer to the higher mass ratios, but still there was this gap here, which is about a factor of 10. And this is sort of the intermediate gas giant planets with mass ratios between 1 to 5 times 10 to the minus 4, or masses of about 20 to 80 Earth masses. So so this is different from what the core accretion theory seemed to predict. So this is a cartoon that shows what the snow line or frost line is. This is thought to be around 2.7 astronomical units for the solar system, and basically ices can condense around here. There's actually several different frost lines because they're different types of ice. 2.7 is for water ice, but there's also CO2 ice and methane ice and so forth. But water ice is probably the densest. And so generally what was thought, and I think this is primarily based on spherically symmetric calculations, is that you get this slow growth here. It's just getting up to around 10 Earth masses in solids, and then you start accreting hydrogen and helium gas, And then you get this runaway growth when the mass in the gas equals the mass of the solids. And so it was thought to be unlikely that this rapid growth would just happen to terminate at this time. So, I mean, one thing that could terminate planet formation is when the radiation from the star expels all the gas. But, you know, that's unlikely to happen at this brief period when this runaway growth is going on. At least that was the thought. Okay, now this is a model from a three-dimensional simulation from Judith Zoology. And so this is now the circumplanetary disk. And she finds that that basically you don't really get accretion in the plane of this disk. Instead, the accretion comes in from the poles, and it's hard for the gas, you know, in the disk to actually get rid of its angular momentum enough to fall into the planet rapidly. So it seems like three-dimensional simulations are not really verifying this runaway gas accretion process. It does depend a bit on some parameters they assume for the disk. And if the disk had a much higher velocity, then the runaway gas accretion would probably be be more correct, because the viscosity would allow the gas in the disk to lose its angular momentum more quickly. And also observations from ALMA seem to indicate relatively low viscosities in the protoplanetary disk that they observed. Previous publications by some of the radio velocities groups had suggested that they might have a desert here. This is from Mayor et al. Paper in 2011, and they suggested that this might be this desert area that was predicted by some of these models. However, I did a statistical analysis of this using data from that paper that was digitized by Rachel Fernandez, and we tried to fit models with gaps. And there are some gaps here. The best fit model has a sort of a gap that's a black curve here, but the two shades of gray are all the models that are consistent with the data at sort of different levels, one sigma in dark gray and two sigma in light gray. And you see that while, you know, there's at these different separations, there is some evidence for you know, the best fit model does have a little bit of a dip. It's not statistically significant. And I think a more recent radio velocity survey has a similar result. So far we've just looked at statistical results that, you know, are the planet to star mass ratio and the separation at Einstein ring units. Okay, but we already know from Kepler that the lowest mass stars have planetary systems, at least in close orbits, that look pretty different from the ones from more massive stars. And so this could also be the case for the stars in these wider orbits. And so so we have this follow-up program that basically we try to detect the planetary host star as it separates from the source. And this actually was a key feature that of a space-based microlensing survey that led to the selection of the exoplanet microlensing survey of the Roman Space Telescope, that the high angular resolution images allow us to do these sort of observations with the same telescope that discovers the events. Okay, and so to measure the masses, we have three different ways of determining a mass distance relation. One is if you measure the velocity that the host star and planet are receding in the sky, or you measure finite source effects, you can measure the angular Einstein radius. So Einstein radius is here, we're at the Earth, and so we measure this angle here. Okay, but if you observed with multiple telescopes separated by an AU or a fraction of an AU, if you're observing a planetary lens, or just the orbital motion of the Earth can allow you to measure what the Einstein radius is projected in the other direction. Okay, and this is referred to as a microlensing parallax effect, because the microlensing effect looks different depending on the position of the observer. And this gives these two mass distance relations. But if you just multiply them together and take the square root, the distance dependence just cancels out, and you get a direct measurement of the mass from this angular Einstein radius and this microlensing parallax parameter. Okay, and then we can use these relations also to determine the distance. Then finally, just measuring the brightness of a star, if we have a mass luminosity relation, then from its apparent brightness, we can work out its distance. And so that's another method we use. So we use a combination of those three methods to get the masses of these planets. So one thing that's been a complication here is, you know, ground-based image of one of the microlensing fields looked like this, and this is centered on a star that was observed to be microlensed. But with Hubble Space Telescope, it looks like this. And these things that look like they could be stars in this ground-based image are actually combinations of multiple stars. And this one right here is the one that was lensed. So to see the lens and source separation, we can't do it with ground-based data because these stars are already blended together. And so this is one of the prime reasons, you know, that we want to do this space-based survey with Roman. So here are some examples of these different mass distance relations for several events. So two of these actually, this one is 67 Earth masses and this one 39 Earth masses. Those are in that location of the desert. And this one has this microlensing parallax. It's only measured in one direction, basically, because it's the direction that the Earth is accelerating during the event. But the detection of the host star separating from the source gives us the angle of this two-dimensional microlensing parallax vector, and that reduces the mass distance relation from this pink one down to the green one. And so this is a method that we've been using to measure masses of these events found from the ground, and it's also developing the method we'll use when we have Roman data. Okay, so this is one event where we measured the microlensing parallax well enough to determine its mass, and the planetary mass is about 10 Earth masses, and the star is a bit more than a half a solar mass. So a lot of this a lot of the observations have been done with the Keck telescopes using the laser guide star adaptive optics. And even though the Keck telescope's in the northern hemisphere and the galactic bulge is in the southern hemisphere, it provides the best data because their adaptive optic systems work much better with fainter stars than others. And so here's several events that have mass measurements. And so here the lens is separated from the source. Here they're still blended, but you can see the image is elongated. These are separated, and these are sort of halfway in between. But here's the mass prediction in blue without the follow-up data, and then in red with the high-resolution images, we can get pretty precise masses. All right. And then this one just shows some microlensing parallax vector, the distribution of it, and you see that the east component is pretty well measured, but the north-south component is not. But with the detection of the host star separating from the source, we know the angle of motion. And so that cuts a swath across like this and gives us this result. So we get a pretty precise measurement of this microlensing parallax because we have this measurement from the follow-up data. All right, here's a few more of these, two more with masses. And in this one, we predicted that we should be able to detect a host star of any mass as long as it was burning hydrogen, but we didn't. We could rule out objects more massive than a solar mass and less massive than 0.16 solar masses from, because some would have a microlensing parallax signal larger than observed and some would have smaller. And so the only option for this is that the host star is a white dwarf. And this is the first detection of a system similar to a planet that started in an orbit like Jupiter that survived the formation of a brown dwarf. This event was actually ambiguous. It had two solutions, one that was due to a star with a planet, another was due to a binary star system. So the light curves were predicted were pretty much the same, but they had different velocities between the lens system and the source star. And we measured the velocity, and it turned out to be that this is a stellar binary, not a planetary event. Okay, so we found, by measuring the masses of some of these, we found that indeed these events with mass ratios that seem to be in this predicted desert between Neptunes and Saturns actually is in the desert. And we have a number of more events like that. All right. I'm going to talk a little bit. With Roman, we're going to be able to do these measurements with the Roman data itself. And we have many, many more images, even though the duration of the prime mission is only 5 years, whereas some of these other measurements were made with a longer duration. Now we want to talk about the free-floating planets. Our MARA group reported evidence for free-floating Jupiters back in 2011, but we should have been suspicious that this signal was coming at a timescale of about a day, because there are other things that happen at a timescale of a day, and one thing that the MOA telescope does differently than the Ogle group is that MOA has a wider passband covering both the standard R and I bands, whereas Ogle just uses the I band. And this is a problem because, if we try to get good observations over as long a timescale at night as we can, that means we're observing at different air masses. And also when our target is rising, the neighbor stars will be on one side, maybe above it, at higher elevation. But then when it's setting, the neighbor star will be at lower elevation. And if that neighbor star has a different color, then atmospheric refraction will put it in a different place. And our photometry code doesn't account for that. And this has led to this feature at around 1 day in this distribution of timescales. And so after this, we started correcting for that. 6 years after this, the Ogle collaboration published this, which didn't have this bump at timescales of a day, but did have some excess events at timescales of less than half a day. So last year, we published, the MOA group published a paper led by two of my Japanese collaborators with a 9-year sample of data with the photometry improved to remove these color-dependent refraction effects. And so we found a distribution that looks similar to the one found by Ogle. However, this calculation used more measurable parameters. So here's some of the events from this calculation. So two of these actually have measured finite source effects. Okay, and this happens when the Einstein ring is not much larger than the source size. It can even be smaller, and so basically the source position sort of crosses. The lens position crosses over the angular diameter of the source, and this leads to a different light curve shape that we can use to measure the source radius. Yeah, go ahead.
Perhaps they're a little bit hard to see. What's on the x-axis for those?
X-axis is time. The black is the light curves. They're a little bit hard to see when the error bars are small, which of course are the most important data points.
Okay. Why are those funny blob things?
In the top panel, you mean?
Yeah, the top line, and then the third.
So those are the light curves over 9 years, and okay. then the bottom panels are less than a day.
Okay. Panel is the special,
right?
The stop ones. Okay. All right.
Right. So the stellar variability background is typically things like flare stars that brighten more often. And so you want to check that we don't see that in other events. I also have some different light curve shapes. So, All right. And the two other groups that I've been working on is Ogle had found the first very low mass planet. And this is with an angular Einstein radius less than 1 milliarcsecond. And this one event from MOA is also very similar angular Einstein radius. And if you plot the distribution of Einstein radii of events that have these finite source effects, there's this gap at a little bit above 10 microarcseconds. And so this is thought to be, this slope here is kind of the distribution of brown dwarfs. And then these events located out here at smaller angular Einstein radius are thought to be, planetary masses. And in order to do this analysis, previous analysis have done just using the Einstein radius crossing time. Okay, and so the low mass objects give small source radius crossing times, but also if the velocities are very high or if the lens and source are very close together, making the Einstein radius small, then you can also get short crossing times. And so with two measurable parameters, then we can get sort of tighter constraints on these. And so these events that we have where we measure the finite source effect give us sort of much stronger evidence that the lenses are planetary masses. Okay. And so we did a fit for the fit of power law mass function for these planetary mass objects. And we fit that in conjunction with sort of known mass functions of stars and to some extent brown dwarfs, but also stellar remnants. And so this plot shows the mass function that we expect. This curve here is from bound planets and stars. We know about the stars pretty well from other observations, but when you get to the brown dwarf mass range, particularly at low masses, we don't know it so well, but we fit for it. This thing in gray is the bound planets. And they have this, seem to have this break in the mass function, whereas these free-floating planets seem to, continue to much lower masses. And, the lowest mass lenses that have been found are these two very low mass free-floating planets, one found by Ogle and one found by MOA. Those are both thought to be less than an Earth mass. All right. So we make estimates of these statistics. We don't have a huge number of events, and so these are a little bit crude. But they do indicate a lot of planets. And so there's about six times as many inferred free-floating planets than known populations of bound planets. So we expect that the Roman Space Telescope, based on these numbers, will find about 1,000 of these free-floating planets down to the mass of Mars, including more than 500 between the mass of Mars and Earth. So these do have pretty large error bars because of the small number of events. Also, these are actually only candidate free-floating planets because we can't guarantee that we would be able to detect a host star if its orbit is very wide. But fortunately, JWST, for a lot of these candidate free-floating planets, we should be able to detect host stars even at the bottom of the main sequence as far away as the galactic bulge. And so if our proposals get accepted, we should be able to test whether these are really free-floating or may have maybe in a wide orbit about a host star. Right. Okay, so I'm done with the talk, and this is just a close-up of that video I showed before. It's nice to have the H-alpha image of the sun to use for this, and then you can see how the images kind of swirl around the location of the planet. So the location of the planet, this is actually in between here and in the middle of this sort of Einstein ring. Okay, so I'm done with my talk, but I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, let's see.
Talk.
That was great.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we have some questions.
Yes.
Here's one.
Any guesses as to why there are so many free-floating planets in comparison to bound planets? Did you hear that?
Okay, well, so we expect actually that the total mass of bound planets is higher. If you have close encounters between planets, orbiting a star, it's always a smaller one that gets tossed out. So that's, having lots of low mass, free-floating planets is, seems kind of consistent with theory, although I don't think anyone's done very detailed calculations. For a long time, people doing simulations of forming planetary systems didn't really keep track of the, planetesimals that got, thrown out during their simulations. I think they tend to do that more now, but oftentimes they start with protoplanets, that have like Mars mass. And so if your initial conditions include all these Mars mass protoplanets, you can't really trust it to tell you how many free-floating Mars mass planets there'll be, because, that was kind of the input to their simulation. They don't really know what the correct number would be in the beginning. I think it's likely that theorists may be looking into trying to test this now, but but there haven't been any detailed predictions. There's also other things that can remove planets. You know, planets in binary star systems can get ejected by the stars. Even very wide stellar binaries, they're actually subject to perturbations from passing stars that can, move them from a very wide circular orbit to a very high eccentricity orbit, where they come in at high speed and, pass through or pass near a planetary system and can, disturb some of those planets or even steal them for their own.
Can I make a follow-up question? So, sure. I think the slide said there's about 5 free-floating planets for every bound one. I assume that's a theoretical prediction rather than...
No. It's an extrapolation of our modeling of the data, right? So we fit a power law mass function, and so we use the result of that fit to estimate how many planets there are.
Okay.
So it's data based, but the it is. It's sort of subject to assumptions on the, the shape of the mass function, and it depends a bit on where we cut it off. So I think we cut it off at maybe a third of an Earth mass. And so sensitivity probably drops below that, and.
Dr. Bennett?
Yeah.
If you have free-floating planets and there's no nearby star to heat them up, would these planets probably have extremely low temperatures, say very close to absolute zero?
It depends a bit on their atmosphere. There's a paper by Dave Stevenson in 1999 claiming that with a high density molecular hydrogen atmosphere, free-floating Earths could have surface temperatures similar to the Earth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, so...
And where does their heat come from?
Radioactive decays. I mean, this is assuming same radioactive decay rate as the Earth.
Okay.
So the energy generation from radioactive decay is about 1/10,000 of what the Earth gets from the sun. So, you have to have a greenhouse effect that's 10,000 times stronger.
That would be one heck of a greenhouse effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
I agree.
I mean, I think this molecular hydrogen, high density molecular hydrogen absorption effect has been detected in very old white dwarfs. It makes them turn blue as they get colder.
Oh.
Because the absorption is very efficient in the infrared.
Any other questions? Okay, here's one.
Well, not so much a question as a note. I didn't hear either John or Guy mention in this. My apologies if you didn't, if I missed it. But Nancy Grace Roman was an active member of National Capital Astronomers for many years. She regularly attended the meetings. He would always have a very cogent question for the speaker. Sure. And then if the speaker left the labels off, went off their diagrams, or the labels were too small to read, she would always call them out on that. So I just wanted to you know, note Nancy's connection with NCA.
Right. We talked a little bit about that before the meeting officially got started.
Well, if there are no other, oh, got another question.
Yeah, but the free-floating planets, are you detecting them observationally via the micro lensing without the presence of a star nearby, or is this just modeling?
Well, so the ground-based observations don't directly detect most of the stars in the bulge. The density of stars, of main sequence stars, is more than one per square arc second. And so the stars, the source stars tend to be not individually resolved unless they're, brighter than a main sequence star in the bulge, which, age of the bulge is old enough, so there's not really, many stars are more massive than the sun. We're detecting them by these photometric effects. From the ground-based images, it's hard to determine, or except the adaptive optics images, but the seeing limited ground-based images, it's hard to know exactly how many stars are in in a given location, and so it's pretty typical to detect microlensing events without being able to see the lens star. There was one example of our follow-up observations where based on the light curve, we could, confidently predict that we would be able to detect, follow-up observations, be able to detect a hydrogen-burning star of any mass, and we didn't detect anything. And this led us to conclude that the host was a white dwarf, which might be detectable by Hubble, but would be detectable by James Webb Space Telescope. But typically, we don't detect the host stars unless we have these high angular resolution observations that can, see the relative movement of the host and the source stars. And occasionally there's stars that are close enough to be, a host star, but they're like, after the event, they're moving toward the source star. And so we can conclude that they're not really related to the microlensing.
If there's no more questions, I want to thank the speaker one more time, and let's all give him. Thank you. Which just for opening up the observatory for us. Given the weather forecast, I do not believe there's going to be any observing.
Yeah, I don't think so. No, it wasn't good when I checked a little while ago, but yeah. I haven't checked.
It's
so
going to be bad for the whole
yep. Street.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming.
Okay.
See you next week.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I will
send thanks for the opportunity.
Batch of swag.
You say you have eclipse glasses to give away?
Yes. Would you like to take some?
Yeah, I love them.
And